Okay, so sorry for this. Thank you very much for the invitation. Let me say first of all, as everyone, happy birthday to Eric. I'm very honored to be part of this conference and to remember Eric's many contributions to analysis. So I'm going to talk about, and of course, special thanks to Christian once more for the kind invitation. So I'm going to talk about Calderon commutators and the Cauchy integral on Lipschitz curves. So let me not tell you what I'm going to say next, but let me just start by reminding you some calculations which generated all these commutators and the Cauchy integral on Lipschitz curves, just to refresh our minds. So some time ago, in the 60s, Calderon made these calculations in connection to problems in PDE, and I like to call them linear growth calculations for reasons that are going to become clearer in one or two slides. So H is the Hilbert transform, as you know. Capital A is a function that is Lipschitz, so A prime is in L infinity, and I like to call it with linear growth. So A of X is X is such an example. And then the main question is whether H, the commutator, is smoothing of order one. He wanted to understand this as part of his big program, as you know. So I'm not going to recall that, but let me just recall the calculations that he did so that you see exactly how this appeared. These are all very standard things, but I like to recall them. If you look at this commutator and you compose it with a derivative and you do the math, you realize that this is what you see, and then you group terms together, you integrate by parts, f prime, the derivative hits here, and then you end up with two terms. Either you differentiate the first expression above, and then you get this, or you differentiate the expression below, and you get that. So then you observe that this thing is just the minus, it's minus the Hilbert transform of A prime over F times F plus the other term, which is the new term, which is the so-called first Calderon commutator. And since, right, and this is C1 that I singled out here. It has this formula which is written by this, by this expression. So, okay, so then more generally, you can talk about more complicated expressions, such as this one. So besides that first Calderon commutator, he came up with a kth Calderon commutators, and besides those, he also mentioned specifically this type of creatures. So where capital F was x before, so f of x was x before for the first commutator, it could be x to the k, in which case you get the kth Calderon commutator, or it could be something else, for instance 1 over 1 minus iz, in which case you get the Cauchy integral on Lipschitz curves. And not only that, but also these expressions like this, more complicated, so you're supposed to take products of as many as you like, f and g being holomorphic, say, okay, I wrote here real analytic, no, I meant holomorphic, say, in a disk of a certain radius around the origin in such a way that the first derivative of A, the norm of that is strictly smaller than the radius, so that this makes sense. And then it is well known that these operators are bounded in LP. That was the main point of this whole theory, to prove that such estimates holds true, and he managed to do that in the case of the first commutator, and then Koifman and Meyer and Koifman, McIntosh and Meyer understood them all. So let me also remind you that the first commutator can be thought as a bilinear, as being a bilinear operator. This was something that everyone knew. And in fact, it has this symbol, very specific symbol. It is integral from 0 to 1, signum of xi plus alpha xi 1 d alpha, which is not a classical symbol. That's the point that I want to point out. So this symbol viewed as a symbol of xi and xi 1 is not a Marcinkiewicz symbol. If it was a Marcinkiewicz symbol, that bilinear operator would not be so complicated. It would be just a para product, and then for it, there is a theory of Kaufmann and Meyer, and that theory could be able to handle this thing. So the first commutator is not a classical bilinear operator. It has this sort of more complicated symbol. All right, so I also want to mention something that I think is interesting, which is the fact that the above calculations also gave the same, the following thing, which is the fact that if you have a function a with linear growth, a prime is in L infinity, and if you have a function g such that g and the derivative of g are in LP, say, then the following equality holds, which means that, which reads as follows. So h Hilbert transform of a times dg equals a h times dg minus this thing. Why is this interesting? This is interesting because, you see, a has linear growth, so a of x is like x. dg is just a function in LP. So a priori, you don't know what you should mean by the Hilbert transform of a product between a function with linear growth and another function in LP. This is not in any LP in principle. But with these calculations, you can view, as long as that function is a derivative of another function which is in LP, say, then you have this equality, which makes sense. Every single term makes sense. So if you look at the right-hand side, you have h of the derivative of g, this is in LP. So this thing is no longer in LP. It's just a product between a function in LP, say, and the function that is linearly growing linearly. So it makes sense to have this such a product. But then you have these extra terms, which are h of a dg, which are basically clearly little a is in L infinity, is the derivative of capital A. This is in LP, so this is makes sense in LP. And then the other one is may make sense in LP as well. So that's an interesting thing. Again, without assuming that a is in L infinity. So Calderon, for his purposes, had in mind that a is not only Lipschitz, but also bounded. So for him, a and a prime were both bounded for the PDE. But I think that this is interesting in itself to make sense of calculations which a priori do not make sense at all. So what I want to say next is the following thing, which I observed one afternoon, which is the following. So you can ask a similar question for polynomial growth, for functions with polynomial growth. So say you ask the following question. Suppose that you have a function a which is not Lipschitz, but suppose it has the property that two derivatives are in L infinity. So something that grows quadratically, let's put it this way. Is it true that the commutator is still smoothing? That's a natural thing, just out of curiosity. And it's not so complicated to come up with, do the same type of integration by parts and see what this amounts to. So if you do the integration by parts, you realize that what you have to do is to take this thing and compose it with two derivatives and see whether it is smoothing, right? So what you do, you just recall what you did before, namely the classical calculation, which is the one that gave rise to this, and then you still have another derivative, so you have to perform another integration by parts. Now, if you do this, then what you observe is that you have now to move the derivative to the left again, so you have to differentiate the guy upstairs once, and then the guy below, and then what you observe is that this thing here, the first term, when the derivative hits the term, the first term, is very simple because a prime and then prime disappear, so you really get the Hilbert transform of a double prime, which is natural. Right, I should have said of a double prime of f, so this is meant to be the parenthesis is to the right of f. So it's h of a double prime of f times f, plus 2 times this term, which term is which is given by this expression. Let me move it like this. And so this expression is in fact given by this kernel. So you have a of x minus ty1 of a of x, which is the Taylor polynomial of order 1 about y calculated at x. And that's a, you have to understand this object if you want to prove that this is smoothing. So, in other words, expressions of this sort appear naturally as well. So, in other words, that's the creature that we came up with on the previous slide. And you wonder, is it true that this maps LP into LP? And it's not so complicated. You can use the T of 1 theorem, for example, for it, and you can do it. So in other words, it is true because of this fact that the commutator between H and A is smoothing of order 2 because of the fact that this is bounded. But then say, okay, what if I take functions which are growing polynomially? So I have the big derivative in L infinity for some D. And you integrate by parts again, and it's interesting that you get exactly this creature, a of x minus the Taylor polynomial, right? So before you had a of x minus a of y is the Taylor polynomial of order 0. Now I have the Taylor polynomial of a certain order, and you divide by the right thing so that everything is a kernel. And then, of course, more generally, you come up with expressions like this, you know, just to follow the classical lines. And you wonder whether expressions like this are bounded, or even expressions like this are bounded for D1 and D2 being two different derivatives, if you like. And one of the theorems that one can prove is that all of these operators are bounded in LP, assuming that the right number of derivatives are in L infinity. In other words, if A has a certain grows polynomially with respect to D1 and the other one B with respect to D2, then you have that these operators are bounded. Particular case, so you may wonder, have you seen this before? I'm not sure if you have seen this before. When I came up with them, I hadn't seen them before. So I didn't know whether these things existed or not. But then if you look in the book by Koefman and Meyer, you see some creatures like this appearing, and in connection with a different problem, also related to Calderon calculations somehow, but not the one that I mentioned. In any case, it was not at this level of generality. It was just for the first commutator and the product of two. The product of two, for example, if f and g are both x, that's a paper by Cohen and Gosselin, which I understood that one of them was a Koefman student, if I'm not mistaken, or Richard may remember him, at Washington University, or Cohen. So in any case, expressions like this have been considered before, and I'm not claiming that this theorem is not provable by the classical, one of the classical approaches. But on the other hand, if you remember, so in any case, I want to say this theorem which holds in general for every f and every g and so on. And the reason for which I want to mention it is that I came up with a new proof of this commutators and the Cauchy integral Lipschitz curve some time ago, which is so robust that for that method, the fact that you proved this or the one before doesn't really, you don't have to work extra, almost at all. So it's just something that you just observe that this is true, and you don't, without any extra effort. So again, it could be that this could be put into a T of one, for instance, this one, quite likely. But for the other one, for instance, I'm not sure. Maybe it's new. I don't. But this is not the point that I'm trying to make. The point that I'm trying to make is the following: is the next one. that I like more, which is the following. So polynomial growth part two. So I want to do it differently. So in other words, everything that you have seen before, I'd like to say let's erase it a little, and then I would like to calculate things in a different way. So again, I wonder again whether if a double prime is nearly infinity, then a the commutator is smoothing of order two, and then I want to observe that this is smoothing of order two if and only if the commutator composed with the Hilbert transform is smoothing of order two. That's not a big deal because every function in LP is the Hilbert transform of another function in LP, so it's not really a big deal. But then you can do the following calculation. So let's check that this is smoothing of order two. So what you do then is the following thing. You write AH minus HA composed with H. First of all, you have to calculate this thing first before you put the two derivatives in it, so that you have to... So I wanted to pay attention to this, because that's, I mean, if you will remember something from this talk, I would like you to remember these calculations. These are really integration by parts, nothing really special. But I'd like to see how a certain creature shows up. So you look at this, you do the math, and it is a h square of f minus h a h f, clearly. But then h square is minus identity, so it is minus a minus h a h f. And then you do the following trick. You write AF in two different ways. You write AF either as h square of AF, or you write AF as A times h square F with a minus. And then you divide by 2, you put a 2 in here. So that didn't change anything, I just rewrote that. The reason for which you do this is the following, is that then if you calculate this thing explicitly, right, so what do I have here? I have two Hilbert transforms which I compose one with the other. Sorry. Thanks. So you do the math in the following way. So you compose H twice with itself. So you come up with this thing. This is H composed with H of FF. So this is identity, minus identity, nothing else, right? This thing here. And then you also have A H square of F, which is this, right? And then you also have this term, which is h of a h f. So how do you write this? You can write it, for instance, like this. If you look at this thing, you integrate first in s, you get the Hilbert transform of f, and then you observe that what is left is Hilbert transform of f times a, and then another Hilbert transform of on top, which is exactly this. Or you can do it with a t and s flipped. I just, the whole thing is completely symmetric, and then you get exactly this other term. Again, look at, you integrate first in T, you get the Hilbert transform of F, then integrate in S, and then it's exactly this thing, which is H of A of HF. In any case, the whole thing, if you do the math carefully, as I did, rewrites, can be rewritten as integral over R square F of T plus, X plus T plus S, times this thing. A of x plus t plus s, x plus t, x plus s, a of x, dt over t, ds over s. And therefore, this is how the operator looks like. I want now to prove that this is smoothing of order 2, so on top of this thing, I have to put two derivatives here, and then to continue with the calculations. That's what I do. So I look at this thing, and I... put two derivatives, so it is minus f double prime of this, and then you integrate by parts in t first. So I want to integrate by parts so that I follow the usual way. So I integrate by parts. I have t and s, so I have to be careful. So first I want to integrate in t, then in s. That's the only way in which you can make sense of all these things. So integrate first in t, then you get something, which means that you can differentiate the term upstairs or the term downstairs, which gives rise to the first term or the second term. Okay, this and this. And I call this a plus b. Again, both of them still keep an f prime, which requires another integration by parts. So let's then look at this and continue with the integration by parts. In other words, I take the first term A and I'd like to clean it. In other words, A had a derivative in it, which I'd like to move to the right by integration by parts. And I get again two terms because I have a product. So one term is the one that contains an A double prime. And the other term is the term that contains an A prime minus another A prime, but divided by the 1 over S primed, which gives rise to an S squared. So what you see is that this term A is very clean. It is exactly, the first thing is just the Hilbert transform of F times A double prime, composite Hilbert transform. So two Hilbert transforms on top of the other. So you get A double prime times F. And then the other one is the Hilbert transform, luckily, composed with the first commutator with A prime of F. If you pay attention carefully, again, I maybe should just say here that usually when you think of the first commutator, you write it like this. A of X minus A of Y over X minus Y, 1 over X minus Y, F of Y dy. But this is also the same as PV, integral over R, A of X plus T minus A of X over T, F of X plus T dt over T. So I bump into this expression more often than into that if I do this. So that's why I said that this is exactly the Hilbert transform of the first commutator. If you look there, you see exactly that this is the case. So in other words, you're right. The first term is fine. A double prime is in L infinity. F is in LP. The other one is also fine. It's just a composition of things. I mean, just using Calderon's theorem. But then if you look at the second term, again, you have to integrate by parts once more. And this gives two terms as before. The first one is exactly of the same flavor. It's exactly minus the Hilbert transform of C of one, or the first commutator of this, plus this creature, which is exactly F of X plus T plus S, times this divided by T squared S squared. So you had 1 over T, 1 over S, which finally you have to differentiate in T and in S. You have to differentiate 1 over T in T, 1 over S in S, which gives rise to T squared S squared. So who is this? I haven't seen him before. The first one is the first one. So the point is that is it true that this is bounded? And I would like to write this thing in the following way. This is what this is. It is just a PV of integral of F of X plus T plus S dt over T composed with ds over S, where dt is just a finite difference of order at derivative at scale T. So the question is it true that this is bounded in as long as F is in LP? Right? So either you do what I did before, polynomial calculations part one, or you do polynomial calculations part two in this way. And you come up with this creature. Similarly, if you happen to want to understand polynomials of arbitrary degree, you do the same thing more carefully and you bump into the following thing. You bump into this. So integral of f of x plus t1 plus td, dt1 over t1 composed dtd over td, a of x, dt1, dt1. So look at the first. The first becomes trivial when a of x is x squared, in which case you bump into the composition of the Hilbert transform with itself, which is identity. The other case becomes trivial when a of x is x to the d, the simplest polynomial, in which case this becomes d factorial or something like that, and then you bump into composition of the Hilbert transform with itself d times. So it is either identity or h. It depends on your whether d is odd or even. So the question is it true that they map, they have any LP properties or not? That's the first question. And the second question is, as I said before, who are they? Can you relate them in a certain way with what we have seen before, with the commutator somehow? What's the correct way to look at them? And so here is what I can say. Again, recall what I wrote there. The first commutator, first of all, can be written like this. Right? I wrote it like dt over t instead of a of x plus t minus a of x. That's the first commutator of Calderon. What I have is let me write it here, the most generic form. The one that I wrote looks like this. Integral of f of x plus t1 plus t2 plus td, and then you have dt1 over t1 composed with dt2 over t2 composed with dtd over td of a of x, and then dt1 over t1 dtd over td. So that's for every d equals 1, 2, 3. So if d equals 1 is the same as this one, if d is 2 or up, then it is this. So how can I compare, for example, that thing with the d Calderon commutator, for example? Is it possible? Maybe it's not a good idea to compare it with the d commutator, but how do you compare that with the commutator of Calderon? Let me remind you that this has a symbol which is integral from 0 to 1, signum of xi plus alpha xi 1 d alpha. That's the symbol where xi is the parameter of little f and xi 1 is the parameter of little a, which is the derivative. Well, what you observe if you calculate it is that the symbol that creature has downstairs is precisely the symbol of the first Calderon commutator raised to the power d. So in other words, it's just that, nothing really special. But now so then you may say, well, can you then prove estimates for that creature as a consequence of the estimates for the first one somehow? Unfortunately not. Because as I said, the symbol is not a classical symbol. If I had a classical symbol, if I raise the classical symbol to the d, that's a cheap thing. It's still a classical symbol, and I have a para product. But the symbol that I have is bad, and I have bad to the power d. And it's not clear what it doesn't help somehow. So, but nevertheless, it is interesting that these things to the power d appear very naturally in connection to this polynomially increasing functions. So in any case, more generally, you ask questions like this, as before. So what if I have a complicated thing, really, in the sense that I have an f of all these things? Or even with more factors, I even didn't write it down. But you can imagine, I have f, g, and so on, so with different... but then, of course, and I may say from the beginning, so the theorem that I have is that all these things are bounded, assuming that the right conditions hold. And maybe I have some time in the end to speak about that new approach that I've told you briefly about. But what I also want to say is to divagate even more. So we are in the process somehow of just writing down creatures on the blackboard or on slides somehow, based on somehow the intuition that you get from considering these objects which appeared, as I told you. So for example, you see a lot of derivatives. Then you ask, what if I consider more derivatives in the very first original object of Calderon? What if I take, instead of dt over ta, which was, for instance, the Cauchy integral Lipschitz curves was like that, what if I consider delta t over t composed with delta t over t, two derivatives like this? I have only one variable, I'm not allowed to take another t2, I'm just looking at this. Is it bounded or not? What if I take more, for example, what if I take this? F of x plus t, I take one derivative, two derivatives. So we can take three derivatives, four derivatives, doesn't matter. Are they bounded or not? Yes, they are all bounded. Again, I claim that without any extra effort, one can prove these things. any extra effort on top of the new proof that I mentioned. So you may say, why do you care about this? In other words, for example, you know, all those things appear naturally in connection with the polynomial story. What about this, for instance, which I just made up? Is it related to something or not? Yes, it is related to the bilinear Hilbert transform, in particular. What do I mean by this? So you see, at the very beginning, right, so I want to look at this thing and this thing. So these two, this and this, the simpler and this. And I have dt over t, dt over t. So, for example, why is it that this is, so let's take a look at this, for example, to explain to you why this is hard and you cannot use a very quick proof for it. For example, this symbol, this, how to say, kernel here is not symmetric. So if you try, for example, to do it quickly with the T of B theorem, as you do if f of x would be 1 over 1 plus ix, for example, where things are fine, this is not, so this is not going to be possible. So the proof with the T of B theorem that is possible for the Cauchy integral Lipschitz curves is no longer possible if you take dt over t composed with dt over t, because the symmetry is broken, so you no longer get the miracles that you get before. So that is not possible. So this is not so easy. The only way in which I would imagine that the classical approaches would work for this, for instance, is to take the approach that Mike Christ and Journet had. If, for those of you who remember, there is a paper that they wrote in the 89, I think, where they proved something in Rn with some sort of a multilinear T of 1 approach, inspired by a new proof of the T of 1 theorem of Koifman and Meyer. And that is something that is robust enough that I would imagine that can be massaged to give a proof of this. But that's the only approach that I know on the Cauchy integral Lipschitz curves, for example, which has a chance of being applicable. So, all right, so I didn't say the connection with the bilinear Hilbert transform. So as a consequence of the fact that this is bounded for f of x is x, which is probably a T of 1, then you can prove the following thing, for instance, namely that that if you take the bilinear Hilbert transform corresponding to factor 2, which means f of x plus t, g of x plus 2t, and if you subtract minus 2hAf plus aHf, that's smoothing of order 2. So in other words, I look at this operator, I take the bilinear Hilbert transform with factor 2 of f and a, and this is, right, so instead of having h of AF, as Calderon started, you start with the bilinear Hilbert transform of A and F. And then you wonder whether the bilinear Hilbert transform can be simplified. In other words, can you write the bilinear Hilbert transform in the same way as you wrote the H composed with A? Yes, you can write this as A composed with H of F plus smoothing of order 2 terms. Of course, this doesn't trivialize Michael's and Christoph's theorem. I'm using that at a certain point in the same way as you are using the fact that Hilbert transform of a prime times f is bounded when you do the math here. Here you get bilinear Hilbert transform of a prime and f, or a double prime of f. But the rest that is supposed to be like the commutator is the one that I was on the previous slide. So that's an interesting thing, I think. When I first observed it, I liked it, because you see, you can come up with with an explanation of something of the following sort. Can you talk meaningfully about the bilinear Hilbert transform of a function that grows polynomially, for example, and another function in LP? In principle, no, in general. But if the function in LP has d derivatives in LP, then there is this composition of integration by parts which allows you to rewrite the whole thing as as you, it allows you to move the derivatives from f on top of the function that, right? So what I mean is that, morally speaking, you have things like this, bht of a times f, as long as you have, say, d derivatives, that's, you know, comparable to bht of d derivatives of f and f, modulo terms of those types. So in other words, you can talk meaningfully about things like this, which have absolutely no meaning in terms of LP estimates or anything like that, which could be interesting because in PDE people consider, you know, imagine that you have a pseudo-differential operator with coefficients which grow polynomially. So sum of a alpha x derivative of alpha where the coefficients are polynomials. A natural thing. So can you cook up some calculations a la Calderon? Yes, if you can observe things like this. That's basically the moral. So in fact, of course, this is smoothing of order 2, but you can ask what about smoothing of order 1? That's even simpler, in fact. So for the bilinear Hilbert transform, or if A has the property that A prime is in L infinity only, then you still have something like this. Again, this is even because of an operator that is even simpler. So in any case, the point is that you can then complicate your life even more, and you can even treat things like this. Suppose that you take the bilinear Hilbert transform with two indices, and then you say, you compose the bilinear Hilbert transform with itself, for example. Take Ts alpha T beta S, dt over T ds over S. This is bounded. It's bounded because the symbol is a product of symbols of the bilinear Hilbert transform type. So signum of xi plus 3 eta times signum of 3 of xi plus 11 eta. That's something that can be treated. They give rise to cone singularities, but those can be treated without too many problems. And one can write the same thing. It is true that this bilinear Hilbert transform can be applied to A times F as before. So, okay, so now you have seen those objects. What I would like also to say is to say a few words about T of 1. Some of them, the simplest of them, are those which are obtained if F of X is X. Those are the analogs of the first commutator, and you would like to apply the T of 1 to them. First of all, you may say, wait a second, but it is not even clear whether those creatures have a good representation in terms of kernels, because if you look at this thing, you know, you may say, what do you mean by T of 1? Where is the kernel and where is the, right? So forget about the kernel. Just, you know, the whole point that I'm trying to make is that is the way of lowering the complexity of this if I apply it to 1. In the for the commutator, this is what it works. You take the kth commutator, you apply it to 1, you get the k minus 1, and so on. BMO is part of the whole picture, and so on. So you like at least, you know, formally to understand whether T of 1 is in BMO. Right, in the commutator case, that's the case. And I'd like to convince you that T of 1 is not in BMO in general. So you cannot apply anything like that. Even though things may look maybe fixable in a certain way. So let me give you a very simple example. So I have, for example, look at this creature, one that is sort of corresponds to the second commutator. In other words, I have two variables, f of x plus t, and I have delta, instead of delta t over t, delta s over s, say I have a and b, which are two parameters. The theorem works, it doesn't, the approach doesn't really pay attention to a and b. So as long as they are different than zero, everything works the same way. So suppose you look at this and then this. I know that this is bounded because I can prove it, but let's assume that you want to calculate t of 1. If you calculate this at 1, then this will disappear, and then you come up with this thing. And then you have observed that that thing is 1 over t double prime, 1 over s double prime. Right? It's 1 over t to the 3, if you keep collecting the T's, one T, two T, three T's, and then one S, another S, so it is like this. And then you integrate by parts. And when you integrate by parts, what is happening is that, of course, you move four derivatives to the left and you have plenty of terms. Some of them are more easy than others, but one particular one which cannot be glued with some other ones at all is this one, when you have a pair of derivatives, T and S, hitting this and hitting both terms separately, in which case you get two derivatives on top of A and two derivatives on top of B and no other terms in here. And that's exactly the bilinear Hilbert transform of parameters alpha and beta for some alpha and beta, if you change variables here carefully, apply to A double prime and B double prime. That's what it means. If you want to check that this is the fact that that operator at one is in BMO, this is it boils down to one thing to understand, whether the bilinear Hilbert transform of two L infinity functions is in BMO. And that's very unlikely to be true, you know, based on what is known about the bilinear Hilbert transform and so on. But let me give you another example where for sure such a thing is not in BMO. In other words, let's assume that instead of this creature here, I have another one which is of length 4. So here I have a product of two terms. Imagine that I have a product of four terms and I do the same thing. If I do the same thing, I bump into a four linear Hilbert transform of the following kind, of the same kind as the one here, but it's just longer. Two derivatives, two derivatives, two derivatives, two derivatives. So you'd like to show that this maps L infinity, L infinity, L infinity, L infinity into BMO in order to have a chance to prove that that is in BMO. And it is known that these objects are unbounded. That's something that I proved some time ago, that if you take a four linear Hilbert transform and you compose it with itself like this, this doesn't satisfy any LP estimates. So in other words, there is no chance for the T of one to enter the picture. So that's about something else. That's why. So, okay, before saying a few words about the proof, all right, so I was more eager to tell you about these creatures rather than the proof, even though you are curious probably to see the reason. Let me say a few words about some other objects which I like to call circular commutators, which I don't know where they are coming from. I'm not sure if they are, you know, worthwhile to be considered anyways, but they are very cute in my opinion. The first one is this. So look at this operator, delta T over T, A of X plus S. So these operators do not have functions in them. They have only kernels. So in other words, I'm looking at this expression, delta T over T, A of X plus S, delta S over S, B of X plus T, DT over T, DS over S. And I call this the first circular commutator. If you want to see the second one, look at this. Delta T1 over T1 composed delta T2, T2, A of X plus T3, 2, 3, 1, 3, 1, 2. And you have this. What can I say about this is that, for example, this thing maps, I think of this as being dependent on A prime and depending on B prime. And I can prove that as long as A prime and B prime are in LP and LQ, then the estimates go all the way to L1 half for this. And there is no cheap way of doing this. So why is it that, right, so I wrote them here. So why is it that I call these circular commutators? You may want to look at them as being bilinear operators, as usual, and you'd like to see what is the symbol of this. Well, the symbol is just completely symmetric. So you just take the symbol of the first commutator of Calderon, which is asymmetric, right? So you average with respect to the xi alpha in front of xi2, not with respect to R. But then you multiply with something where xi1 and xi2 are flipped. So you take the symbol of the first commutator, and then you multiply it with the flipped one. So it's symmetric, xi1, xi2, xi2, xi1. And then if you want to take a look at the other one, you just take the symbol of the second commutator, which is exactly this thing, and then you multiply it with all the you know, the using the circular permutations, and then you take all the products, and then that's exactly the creature that I wrote. So all of them satisfy all the LP estimates as I mentioned. All right, so a few words about the proof. So what is the proof about? Okay, so I don't have, even though I spoke about this several times, I mean, not so many times, but with some occasions, I still don't have the papers for it, at least available. I have two preprints containing all these things, so which will be posted, I don't know, this summer. If you like to take a look at them, I can give them to you. But somehow in 5 minutes, it's hard to say everything about it. The point is that, just to mention some of the main ideas. So the idea is based on three things. So I'll just wave hands, unfortunately, but at least for those of you who are more familiar with this area, you'll smell a few things. So first of all, there are three important ideas that made a difference at that time. The first thing is about the quadratic estimates for the symbol of the first commutator. So what do I mean by this? As I said, the first commutator is not a classical symbol. So usually you cannot think every symbol. You cannot do the usual things. But what you can do, which resembles the classical story, is to observe that if you take Whitney boxes like this, so this symbol is bad along this thicker lines. Away from these two lines, it looks like a classical symbol. So you have to be careful only along those two lines. Now, the point is that if you restrict these two symbols to one of these cubes, which is a Whitney cube with respect to the origin, what is happening is that the Fourier coefficients of this decay quadratically, instead of arbitrarily decay as it does, as it is the case in the classical case. So that's important. The other thing is that you can also prove logarithmic bounds for the shifted maximum and the square functions. What I mean by this is that the shifted maximal function is the one that you take the sup over all the intervals containing an x, but not you don't take the sup over this, but the average that you take is over an interval which sits n steps of the same length away from it. That's important in this thing, and it's important to realize that you don't grow too much, because quadratic decay it doesn't match well with polynomial growth, so you have to be careful with the logarithmic bounds. And the other thing is, okay, so if you know A, you can prove everything about the first commutator. You don't need anything else. You need B if you want to put this on poly disks, for example, which work as well. I can put this on the poly disk, for example. And it also, all right, so if you need Cauchy integral Lipschitz curves, you need C very badly. And let me tell you why. This is something very interesting that I didn't expect, but in a way, it has to be true. It had to be true in order for the whole thing to work. So in other words, what you gain from A is that the symbol of the first commutator is not that bad. It is not a classical symbol, but it has quadratic estimates, so you can do something. That's the moral of the story. Now you say, well, take a look at the second Calderon commutator, and look at the symbol and see is it like that? Is it sort of a weak variant of the classical symbol or not? No. So the symbol of the second commutator is bad. So the symbol of the second commutator doesn't have quadratic estimates as it does the first one. So in other words, you cannot take the second commutator and do something like that. It's not working. It's not true, in fact. And what's the point? The point is to realize, in order to obtain, of course, the polynomial estimates that you are aiming for in order to be able to sum the whole series, as Calderon and Koifman and Meyer and McIntosh accomplished, is to realize that the correct way to look at this symbol, for example, this symbol of the second commutator and all the other commutators, which are integral from 0 to 1, 0 to 1, signum of xi plus alpha, xi 1 plus beta, xi 2, the alpha, the beta, it's not a good thing to look at them as a symbol depending on xi, xi1, xi2, and treat it as such, even though it's very tempting. The correct way, as it turns out, is sometimes you have to consider it as being, sometimes your Q1 variable is the one that you like for some other reasons, and you consider this as being some sort of an average of symbols of the first commutator. And sometimes it is Q2, the variable that you like, and you consider it like that. So in other words, you never have to understand the symbol of the kth commutator as a whole. You just have to realize that it's always some sort of an average of commutators of order one. So the commutators of order one are the ones that dictate the tempo. Let's put it this way. Symbols of commutators of order k are bad. You cannot do things with them. And so somehow that's what the proof is about. It's about realizing all these things, putting them together, and obtaining estimates for them. And the point is that since I work with the symbols, which is the first approach which works with the symbols, I can treat many other symbols in the same way. All those things have symbols. If you try with kernels, as everybody else does, you don't have good kernels because you have T1, T2. You cannot write it as a classical K of X minus Y, K of X and Y, and so on. So T of 1 is not in BMO, so it's over from that point of view. So, okay, so let me stop here. Thank you.